I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to She Started It with Angelica Malin, the podcast that celebrates incredible, inspiring women who are at the top of their industries, from food to fashion, law to politics. This is a podcast about celebrating female entrepreneurship, power and potential, exploring what it really takes to be a trailblazer in today's world. I'm your host, entrepreneur and journalist Angelica Malin, and every week I'll be asking a new guest for their three career turning points and answering the question we've all wondered at some point, how did she start it? She Started It with Angelica Malin is kindly sponsored by Bloom & Wild. If you're like me and you love having fresh flowers around you while you're relaxing at home, but I hate having to carry them around with me all day, and who's ever home long enough to arrange a delivery anymore? Bloom & Wild have got us covered. They're the UK's top-rated online florist, and they deliver right to your letterbox. So you can get fresh buds, ready to flower, they can last up to 10 days, and you don't even have to worry about being home for the delivery. They'll give you £10 off your first order with the code SHE. Straight and simple, S-H-E. They offer free next day delivery up to 10 p.m. They ship across the UK, France and Germany, so they've got you covered. So head on over to bloomandwild.com, use the offer code SHE so they know I sent you, and treat yourself. My guest today on She Started It needs no introduction, but I'm going to give her one anyway. Cherie Blair is a leading human rights lawyer, philanthropist and committed campaigner for women's rights. In 2008, she established the Cherie Blair Foundation, inspired by her experiences of meeting women across the world during her time in Downing Street as the wife of former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. The foundation empowers women to build small and growing businesses in low and middle income countries so they can contribute to their economies and have a stronger voice in their societies. In 1995, Cherie became a Queen's Counsel, and in 2000, she became a founding member of Matrix Chambers, a groundbreaking legal practice focusing on human rights and public law. In 2011, she set up the Omnia Strategy, a pioneering international firm providing the opportunity for barristers, solicitors and non-lawyers to work collaboratively to provide strategic counsel to governments, corporates and private clients. Cherie, thank you so much for joining me today. What an honour.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. And in particular, not saying as what once I was introduced by somebody who decided I was the former wife of the Prime Minister. So got a bit muddled up there.
I can imagine. Has that been frustrating for you ever, being like the association? Do people presume that you aren't a career woman in your own right?
Well, I think that when Tony first became leader of the opposition, they did an interview with me and I said I'd grown up being the daughter of someone. Now I seem to find myself the wife of someone, and I anticipated eventually I'd be the mother of someone. But actually, I do also have my own career.
A fantastic career
but,
at that.
No, it's not frustrating. Of course, I'm very proud of all that my husband has achieved and also very proud of what I managed to achieve. And funnily enough, the one time it was a bit frustrating was when we went into Downing Street, because I still remain the only female spouse, because I think, to be fair, I mean, Philip May still holds down a full-time job, but the only female spouse of a prime minister holding down a full-time job. My two successors both did part-time work, and Downing Street just didn't really understand the fact that I wasn't instantly on tap to do what they considered was the wife's job. And so it took a bit of time for them to understand that I did have my own career.
When your husband came into power, was there a bit of an assumption that you might give up your job?
Yes, but there was never any question of that, because I figured just because he changed his job, it didn't mean that I should be changing my job, which I'd spent by that time over 25 years getting to become a QC, which I'd become a QC in 1994. So this was only 3 years on into a QC. I mean, why on earth would I give that up just because my husband's job had changed? And eventually they accepted that.
So diving straight in, I ask all of my guests to give to me three career points that they feel were very important to them and they look back on and they were turning points in their careers. Could you tell me your first turning point that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think I'd first of all go back to the beginning of my career as a lawyer and to my early life, because I was brought up in Liverpool in an ordinary working class family there, but we were slightly different in that my father was an actor, and he became famous as a famous son of Liverpool as one of the very early comedy soap shows, for want of something better, called Till Death Do Us Part. It also, of course, led him, when I was 8, to actually effectively abandon my mother and my sister and I, and so my mum was left to bring us up with the help of her mother-in-law, my grandmother. Both my mum and my grandma had, for different reasons, left school at 14, and they were absolutely obsessed with making sure that my sister and I had all the education opportunities that they had been denied. And it turned out I was quite a clever girl. And so as I went through primary school and was one of only 3 children in the 70 kids in my primary school year who actually passed the 11 plus and got into my grammar school, and then at the grammar school did very well, I got into this idea that so long as I worked hard and was good at what I did, there was nothing that could hold me back. And that was certainly something that took me very easily, well, quite easily anyway, through school and getting to go to LSE, London School of Economics, where I got the top first in the University of London in law, and then going to Lincoln's Inn as a barrister and becoming top of the bar finals. And it was only when I then had to do the next thing that you had to do after you'd done all your exams, you then do a year's pupillage, we call it. It's like an apprenticeship, going around with a lawyer in a barrister's chambers. And it was only then that I suddenly discovered they hadn't told me the whole truth, the nuns and my mother. And that actually it wasn't just about being good at what you do and working hard. There was a problem. And that problem was that I was a girl. And so at the end of my year's pupillage, my pupil master said to me, "Cherie, you know, there's only one vacancy here. We've got 2 candidates. One's a boy and one's a girl. So obviously we'll go for the better bet, the boy." Wow. And obviously, by the times, that seemed like the better bet. But it was certainly a big shock to me. And actually, it didn't prove to be a terribly long-term decision for the chambers either, because here I am 40 years on, still a lawyer, and the boy buggered off after 7 years and did something else. He was, of course, Tony Blair, and so I suppose he did quite well.
Wow, that's amazing.
So if you like that turned now, to be fair, my pupil master found me another place to start my practice and was very supportive in many ways, and it also taught me something else, I suppose, which was the power of having someone who is not just your mentor but also your sponsor who can help you is very important in building up a professional career. I think it's important in any business, and that idea of mentoring and of the power of mentoring stayed with me both during my legal career when I tried to be a mentor and help to other particularly female lawyers coming up behind me, but also when I went in to found the foundation, and one of the pillars of what the foundation do is still mentoring women in business. The turning point was the shock, setting my mind to doing something and it not actually happening.
And not in the way that you expected.
Yeah, but it did happen in a different way, and it taught me a lesson, I think, has also taught me. I went on in my career starting off very much doing employment disputes, and it was a time when the law was changing, the Sex Discrimination Act had come in, and I ended up making a career doing a lot of cases about equality and discrimination. So, you know, that passion partly came from a sense that I'd experienced, I don't like to say discrimination, but just the way things were at the time were not very women friendly.
Yeah.
Now, it's not the case now, and I wouldn't want to put anyone off as a young woman coming to the bar. I don't think today going to the bar, being a female, is a disadvantage. I do think that there are other disadvantages which mainly come from lack of financial backup and resources. But that's a different story.
Well, I was going to ask you how you think that compares to the experience now of training to be a female lawyer? I imagine there are a lot more women. I think it's about half an hour of female lawyers.
I think in the actual profession, it's less than half-half, certainly less half-half than the bar. But certainly if you look at the law schools, I mean, when I went to LSE, there was a class of about 70 and only 12 of us were female. I mean, it was much smaller group. My daughter studied law. You know, a class of over 50% of them are women. And that is certainly, it's a well-trod route now, I think, into the profession. And no one would say, as they did say when I was looking for pupillage, things like, well, we don't take women in these chambers because the clients don't really like it. Mm-hmm. Or, oh, well, we would take a woman, but we've got one already. And how can we possibly have two? Because then we might have a problem if you both got pregnant at the same time. I mean, that sort of thing doesn't happen. But as I said before, my other issue was at the time, because I had no money. But at that time, I was lucky because I had a full grant to go to university. I actually got a discretionary grant to do my legal professional exams. But today, it's much harder for someone without financial resources behind them. To get that.
And from what I know, the retention of female lawyers is a lot worse. So you see them dropping off. I interviewed a young female barrister yesterday, and she was saying that you see them dropping off. The older they get is that they don't stay as lawyers like men do.
Well, you see, but that's the... Then you might say, well, surely that means that those people back in 1976 who said, you know, it's not really the job for a woman are right, and they are not right. But what we need to do is to change the way and the structures and the approach, not just of the law profession, actually, but of business in general, to deal with what I think is still an issue. And that is, how do you balance your work life and your family life? And that is not simply a women's issue, because there are plenty of young men these days who are also interested in not just being distant, remote father figures to their children, but actually actively engaging with the and sharing the responsibilities of being a parent. And I think that there are ways and means of doing that, and we see it now. We see a lot more women coming up in the profession. It's still not good enough, but the challenge is the work-life balance, I think. And then the secondary challenge is that when I was starting, there was a lot more legal aid available. But the cutbacks in the legal aid fund has meant that many cases which 10, 20 years ago you'd actually have had a lawyer helping you with your case, you just don't get that anymore. And the additional strains that puts on the legal system and the ability of lawyers to actually earn a living.
The challenge is that, yeah, that adds on to it. Well, that leads me, thank you, Cherie, very neatly on to my second turning point that we wanted to discuss, which was the impact of technology and the balance of having four children and balancing this amazing career that you have. Could you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yes, well, I first got involved... You can hardly imagine it now, but when I started in the law... You know, everything we did, the opinions we wrote, the work that we did for court, everything was done longhand, you know, written down. And then what would happen, there'd be a typing pool, and so your work would go and it would be typed out. And the more junior you were, the further down you were in the queue. And that was the way things were done. And then in 1988, I was pregnant with my third child, my daughter. And, well, two things happened with Catherine, actually. The first one was, by this time we had another woman in chambers, and she'd also got pregnant around the same time, so that two pregnancy issue did arise. But she had had problems during her pregnancy. She was very sick and didn't feel very well, whereas I had been lucky enough to sail through my first two pregnancies quite easily. And so she then went and said, excuse me, but I need some help with, because in those days, they still are, barristers are self-employed professionals. And one of the things we have to do is we have to pay for our room and our desk and the expenses of running our practice. And we contribute to that jointly. And for the first two pregnancies, I continued to pay all my share of the expenses, even though for a few months at least, I wasn't able to actually work at all. But she, obviously having this problem throughout her 9 months, was finding it very difficult. And so it was agreed that she would have, she wouldn't have to pay this chamber's rent for a certain amount of time. So I turned up and said, oh, well, actually, you know, I'm pregnant as well. Can I have that as well? Now, it wouldn't happen today because now there are rules. It's professionally not permissible not to make concessions for women. But that was a change. But the second thing that happened was that my chambers, just before I went to give birth, moved radically, as many chambers were doing from the time, from having a manual accounting system where the clerk would write down your fees and his percentage of that take in a book, to having it done on a computerized system. And as part of that, chambers was given two, you probably even haven't heard of these, Olivetti PCs and a package called WordPerfect version 5. And of course, they turned up in chambers and everyone sort of looked at them and said, what on earth are we going to do this? And I said, well, I'm off on my 2-week maternity leave. And I learnt typing, as it happened, when I was a student. So give it to me and I'll take it away and see if I can work out what to do with it. And actually, I did work out what to do with it and realised it could make a huge difference to the way I organised my work as a barrister. By two years after that, I've become chair of the bar's IT committee and was very committed to saying we can use technology to transform the way we deliver services to our clients and to transform the way courts work. And, of course, we have seen a revolution as far as that goes. So that was my first introduction to technology, and I discovered that I actually was a bit of a techie and quite liked it. The second thing, of course, that happened is that I'd said that Tony had become an MP. He became an MP in 83, and obviously we got married. And his constituency is in the northeast of England, which was like 400 miles away. And we used to go up at the weekends. And I then, as things went on, started to get involved with early experiments with file transfers using modems. And again, some of you who listen to this may be old enough to know what a modem is, but it was very, very revolutionary and exciting at the time. And it really made a difference to me to be able to communicate, to be able to send files up to County Durham, from London and backwards and forwards, without having to worry about carrying a whole load of stuff with me, along with the three children at that time and the bag of groceries for the weekend shop and all the other things that we had to do as we were going up as the constituency family.
It's amazing because we so take all these things for granted now, but we forget that there was a time where you would have to physically go and take the files. Do you think we've gone a bit too far with technology, though? Because from a lot of the interviews that I've done, all I hear now is how much people are sick of technology and they feel too connected and they don't have to have a conversation in real life. Have you also seen that as well?
Well, I think for me, I still recognize it as a blessing, but you're absolutely right, of course. There are always pluses and minuses, and one of the minuses is now you can never really escape, can you? And I know I'm as guilty of it as many other lawyers, so you know, yes, it's marvelous. My clients can get me all the time, but yeah, sometimes you really don't want them to get you, but it's a lot harder to pretend that you haven't noticed. That they want to get you. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, in those days as well, you know, you didn't even have mobile phones, remember?
So, it must have been a bit more relaxing, I can imagine.
But there were, yeah. But then you had to write everything out by hand. So, I mean, you know, there's pluses and minuses. Yeah.
Well, now the very trendy thing is called Offline 48, which people do on the weekends.
Yes,
and they
absolutely.
Go 2 days off, no technology.
Absolutely.
Get out into nature.
Yeah, and it's really really important and to make sure that not just that you do it, but also that the people who work for you understand that they don't always have to respond.
Yeah, those late night emails. Yeah. Well, I know that technology has been an important part of your foundation, and I would love if you could tell me a little bit more about the foundation, what inspired you and what you do today with it.
Well, absolutely. And I suppose that's, if you like, is the third turning point. So we roll on now to 2007 and Tony standing down as Prime Minister. And my thinking, you know, well, what do I want to do? And by this time, of course, I had been very fortunate to be able to travel around the world. And when I used to travel either with Tony as he on one of his prime ministerial visits or perhaps on my own, I would find myself often going to meet both other lawyers, but also they would take me and meet some incredible women. And what I realised there was that the women I was meeting, many of them were in the position, certainly a similar to position to what I was in the 1976, in relation to where they stood, the first person in their family to do something, perhaps the first person, the first woman to become an engineer or whatever it is within their communities. And some of them, of course, were in societies where they were probably more in the position of my mother and grandmother were. In other words, forced to leave school at 14, perhaps because they got married young or just because girls' education was not valued. And I thought, you know, I wanted to do something to help those women. And particularly, I was very keen on helping women entrepreneurs. Why? Because actually, as a self-employed barrister with my own legal practice, I was, to some extent, an entrepreneur. And you mentioned, I've always been interested in how we can deliver legal services more efficiently and in new ways. And you mentioned I set up Matrix Chambers in 2000 and then later on in 2011 Omnia Strategy. So that and the foundation, I think I actually am a bit of a serial entrepreneur.
I think you are. I think you can take that term.
Myself. So I wanted to help women entrepreneurs in the what we call low and middle income countries, because I thought that we could really move the needle there, and that there's no reason why they would have to wait the 100 years it's taken, for example. It's been 100 years since women in our country got the vote, and, you know, because now we know much better what works and what doesn't work, and let's use that to accelerate the progress. Because I believe that if you can help women earn their own money and stand on their own two feet, then they are able to make the choices that are right for themselves, and those choices are not only right for themselves, but they're right for their families, their communities, and actually to the development of their country.
It benefits everyone.
So that was the idea. And then I realised, you know, is technology only for the fortunate women like me in developed countries, so that, you know, all the things that I was able to do to make my life easier? Surely there must be a way of using technology to help these women too, not least because I had noticed even then, and it's more so now, that, you know, you were seeing more and more of people in low and middle income countries using the mobile phone, which I always say is the poor person's computer. It's their link to a much bigger world than that which is immediately around them.
Yeah.
So how do we utilize that? How can we help women entrepreneurs make things happen and take it to scale and help it accelerate that progress by using technology? That was the impetus for the foundation, and it's been our mission ever since, I think, in that we use technology as a way of providing business training services to women, helping them with access to mentors and networks that enable them to either set up a business, or if they've got an existing business, take it to that next stage.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Did you, on the topic of mentorship, how important has mentorship been for you? And have you had the same mentors throughout your career? Have you had them always in a formal capacity, or have you met people along the way in your journey?
No, I think most of my mentors have actually been more informal. But you know, we started off, and there is a tradition in any event in the way the bar is organized that the more senior members of chambers do bring on the more junior members of chambers, and to some extent that is in fact mentoring. So it's always been something that was built into the system. And though my pupil master wasn't able to get me into chambers, he remained a sponsor of mine and brought, recommended me to solicitors and brought me into cases for many years after I'd left those chambers, which I was very grateful. And then after that, the people who took me on, Freddie Reynolds QC, was a huge help to me, and later on Michael Beloff QC. But you'll notice they all have something in common. They're all men.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, have you had any strong female mentors?
In the law, not so much, because I think I didn't say, but you know, when I went to the bar, it was the first time the number of women had gone at the bar had gone above single figures. Mm. So it went from 9 to 12%.
So they just weren't there.
Now there were some,
yeah,
but many of them were young, like me, so weren't in a position, if you like, to be mentors. Now, there were, however, role models. Mm-hmm. And indeed, my first role model probably was Rose Halbron QC, who herself was a young Jewish girl from Liverpool, mm-hmm, who went on to become the first woman QC in 1949 and a very, very famous daughter of Liverpool. My grandmother was a huge admirer of Rose and used to go and watch her in the days when the entertainment was provided differently because people didn't have multi-channel TVs, used to watch her plead cases in court. And I think subliminally that idea that one girl from Liverpool could make it in the law meant that I thought I could make it too. So she was not a mentor, but she was definitely a role model. And subsequently, you know, there always were, and there still are, and one can see that because I was just reading today, for example, Heather Hallett QC, who is now, well, she was QC, she's now a senior judge in the Court of Appeal, is about to stand down because she's reached 70. I mean, she was already someone who was pioneering. Brenda Hale, the senior judge at the Supreme Court now. These were women that were already starting their careers. So there were a few, mm, but I didn't personally know any of them then, though I do know them personally now. But
how does
the beginning?
Yeah. How does the mentorship in your foundation work in practice, and what impact have you seen it have on these women?
I'm very proud of the mentoring program because it goes back to those days when I was thinking what to do, and I would go around and I would talk about women's issues anyway. I've always been passionate about women's equality and talked about it a lot. And often women, you know, I'd go and talk about it in America or here, and people would come up and say, you know, what can I do to help? And I thought there must be a way of channeling that desire, not simply to give money, but actually to have a relationship, if you like, and really help somebody that we could channel. And so when we set up the foundation, I thought, how do we plug these two things together? And I was lucky because I'd written my book, Speaking for Myself, and Google asked me to go along. They did this thing, I don't know if they still do, where they have authors come and talk about their book. So they asked me to come along to talk about my book. And at the end, in questions, I was saying, you know, I really want to see how we can use technology to link up these willing people here. with women entrepreneurs who really could do with a mentor. Mm. And so they said, well, you know, let's see if we can help you with that. And that was the beginnings of what became our mentoring platform, which we really first launched in 2010 with a little pilot with only 30 women mentees and a mixture of, I think at that point, 30% of the mentors were men. And it's now grown to, I think we now have reached 3,000 pairs and, or 3,000 people, sorry. The mentoring program covers over 100 countries, from Mexico to Kazakhstan, from Pakistan to South Africa, from Vietnam to the Balkans, for want of a... And so we're in all these countries. And the basic idea is it's hosted on a private platform, but it uses all the Google tools. And we train our mentors. So if you come and be a mentor for the Sri Blair Foundation, you will have training in mentoring skills, and in particularly in listening. And we say to all our mentors, you are not there to solve the problems for the women. You are there to help them reach their decisions.
Solve their own problems.
And how they solve their own problems, which I think is very important. And we ask our mentors, who have to have at least 7 years' experience, to give 2 hours a month to support a women entrepreneur using the internet. So whether it's text messaging, whether it's emails, or a lot nowadays, a lot of it is WhatsApp conversations, mm-hmm. or Skype. That's how the relationship works. But the mentoring platform, which I always envisage that one-to-one relationship, what's amazing about working with women anywhere, but particularly in low to middle income countries, is they do things that you can't even begin to imagine because, of course, you're not in their situation. And what has been amazing about the mentoring platform is the way it's developed into a community itself. So the women don't only have the support of their mentor, but each of them, the mentor and the mentee, are also part of a global community. And we have various forums and chats and helplines, and we have a library of resource materials. We get interesting people to come and do webinars, and the women can phone in and ask questions. So it's a real community. And even after the year, many of our participants remain on the platform and still participate. And it's proved tremendously successful because I'm a great believer in evidence-based. There's no point in doing something just because it makes you feel good. You've got to work out, is it making
a
difference?
The proof of it.
And so we actually got a proper survey done about what was happening. And we found of the men, just in this last year, we looked, 97% of our mentees gained business skills and confidence, 95% improved communication skills, 91% gained new clients, 82% found ways of accessing new markets, 60% went on to hire employees, that was 974 new jobs were created, and there was an amazing ripple effect. 86% of the mentees wanted to commit to help others afterwards, and 62% had already done that. So that's just in a core cohort of, what, 600 women?
Just this last year. Just this last year, so two lots of 250, so probably 500.
Yeah, all right, so 600 wasn't too far.
No, good.
Actually, yeah. I was thinking, I'm this, I knew it wasn't just 250. Yeah. No. Yeah, all right, 500 women.
500 women.
From this last year. I should also say the mentors also reported that it had changed their lives.
Mm.
For many of them, it had revitalized their interest in what they were doing themselves. It had enabled them, if not to develop new skills, to rekindle old skills that they hadn't been using so much. It had improved their confidence in what they were doing. So it really is a virtuous circle. So,
well, confidence was the word that I was going to use. As I feel, as a female entrepreneur, confidence is a thing that we all struggle with,
yes,
the most. And I imagine having a mentor in that formal capacity really is an amazing boost of confidence.
Yes, because one of our mentees described it once, and it was in one of the reports where we had it assessed. She said, my my mentor is my invisible friend who walks alongside me on my business journey.
That's lovely.
And that is, yeah, really, really lovely. And the real friendships are formed as well, which is amazing.
What are some of the challenges of running something on a global scale like that?
Well, first of all, I have to make the point that I do not run the foundation. Mm. I am its founder, I'm its patron, but the foundation is independent from me, so I'm not a trustee. Mm-hmm. We have a board of trustees, and we have an excellent CEO, and we started off with one, two, three. We now have, 25 people in the foundation who it is their jobs to make sure the foundation runs. Mm. But like any charity, because that's what we are, one of the biggest skills is just making sure you keep the lights going. And, and feel very strongly that because we're a foundation that works with women entrepreneurs, we ourselves need to demonstrate that we are entrepreneurial and to try and run the business as a social enterprise. Mm. Interestingly, a large number of our mentees are social entrepreneurs. Yes, they have a business as well. They have a business, but that business has a large social component. So I suppose one of the challenges for me as the founder and patron is to make sure I don't meddle too much.
Allow them to do the great work. You've had such an amazing and rich career. What are you still determined to achieve?
Oh, my goodness. I'm certainly not giving up yet. The fact is, when I started as a young barrister and I started on this role, and I was lucky enough to do some of the very early cases and even the later cases in relation to women's issues and women's equality, naively you thought, well, we've passed the Sex Discrimination Equal Pay Act, this will all be sorted, and here we are 40 years on and it's not all sorted, and there are still many, many issues that remain. We still have a pay gap. We still have issues over sexual harassment, certainly unconscious bias, if not actual bias. All of these issues remain the same. There's no country in the world where women have exactly the same opportunities as men, and there are many countries in the world where their opportunities are severely limited. There's over 20 countries in the world where a woman can't even take a job or leave the country without the express permission of her male guardian. And I feel very strongly that as long as women around the world are restricted, then no woman is really truly free.
Yeah, we have a collective responsibility, I suppose.
We do, and it's not just our collective responsibility, because if in the world there are still these attitudes out there that say women are second best, then even though we think we're treated as though we're not second best here, somewhere lurking in the background is that idea, well, maybe it could change. Mm.
What do you think the government can do about these inequalities? How can we change it?
Oh, well, look, I mean, the government can do a lot, and I'm very proud of the fact that my husband's government did a lot. I don't know if you even remember 97, but there was a whole thing, if you remember, about, well, you probably don't remember the Blair Babes thing, but that was the first time there were more than 100 women MPs due to the policy that my husband had instituted, which was about all women shortlist, to ensure that we got women's voices heard and represented in Parliament. And the reaction of many in the press was to scoff and call them all, ciphers and Blair Babes. So that's not all that long ago. Mm. The policies like the minimum wage has made a big difference to female employment. Issues in relation to work-life balance, nursery education, all of these things all make a difference. They're all something that the governments can do. And just recently, for example, we've seen the reporting that has to give, that big companies have to do about the gender pay gap in their own companies. And this is only in its second year, but what it is throwing up is some interesting analysis about what's going on, and it's not a perfect measure by any means, but all of these things have been driven by governments. Mm. Now, if you go wider than that and look at the countries where we're operating, in some of these countries, they don't have any legislation preventing sexual harassment. In some, many of these countries, they don't have equal pay legislation. In some of these countries, there still are real difficulties about women owning property. One of the things we find with our women entrepreneurs in, say, some of the African countries where there isn't a proper registered title to land, it's much more difficult for female entrepreneurs to raise money because they don't have collateral, because often people are looking for particularly land as collateral, and there's no proof of who owns the land, and the assumption is it belongs to the husband, not jointly to the husband and wife. Again, these are all issues that the laws can change, and you can't change the laws without having the right people in Parliament to do that.
Yeah, the people who are championing these issues and really care about them.
That's why female representation really matters, and why actually I still am in favour of quotas and for women in Parliament. And also, actually, for women on boards.
Yeah.
But women on boards is not enough. Because you've got to look at where women are progressing to the executive, to the C-suite. And therefore, one needs active policies to enable women to progress in their careers.
Yeah. Well, it's about having a seat at the table, isn't it? And I think that's really important. Well, Cherie, thank you so much. You've been the most wonderful guest, the first guest of our season. Thank you so much for joining me. If people would like to find out more about the Cherie Blair Foundation, where should they go online?
Oh, it's www.cherieblairfoundation.org.
Fantastic.
/mentoring if you want to be a mentor.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to She Started It with Angelica Malin. If you've enjoyed this episode, then don't forget to subscribe, rate and review. And you can follow me on Twitter at Jelly Malin.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.